It was the Rolls-Royce engine business scandal, and it came to light in specific detail in January 2017 and revolved around accusations of widespread bribery and corruption within Rolls-Royce PLC, which is, as you said, it's a British multinational aerospace and defence company. The allegations at the time indicated that Rolls-Royce had engaged in corrupt practices over absolutely decades to win contracts in countries pretty much all around the world. And the number of years in which they were kind of offering bribes was just monumental.
Hi there, and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm Mike, and joining me in today's episode is My Wall Street's chief investor, Emmett Savage. If you like what you hear and want to see more from us, head on over to mywallstreet.com/invest and sign up today. In addition to our weekly stock pitch and 10 foundational stocks to build your portfolio on, we've just added 3 wildcard picks to the platform. Wildcards are high-risk, high-reward stocks that we've identified to turn their fortunes around. So to get all that and more, sign up for Invest today and level up your investing game. For more information, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. Today's podcast is brought to you by Vodafone Business. Now, if you're like us here in My Wall Street, you'll know running a business is difficult. There are countless things to think about, and many often simply get ignored or completely forgotten about. That's where Vodafone Business can help. They've crafted a suite of tools and supports to boost your business's operations, and the best part is it's free for everyone. From cybersecurity to harnessing the power of AI, building a website, and improving how your teams work remotely, Vodafone Business will help you address the often overlooked but crucial elements for your business's success. To get started today, check out their one-to-one VHub digital support and advice service. You'll find everything you need right there. Find the link in our show notes or simply Google Vodafone VHub for more details. Now, let's get into today's episode. Emmett, how are we doing?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Did you text your best mate a congratulations there on Monday morning?
Cillian Murphy. Well, I have to say it was a great show. It was a really enjoyable Oscar show, I thought. Now, I have a big fan of the movies in my house. So for the first time ever, I placed a bet, and of course our listenership laughs. But what I mean by that is I downloaded the Paddy Power app temporarily. I asked my son, who is very much involved in the academic level of movie making, like, what's going to win? And he said, well, there's 3 I'm sure of. And he said, Zone of Interest for Best Sound, Godzilla Minus One for Best Special Effects. He's Cillian Murphy for Best Actor, and we both kind of disregarded that one because the odds were 1-40, so not worth it. And the third one that we actually placed a bet on was best, I forget, it will catch up with me, but all 3 came in, and it's the first. And do you know what, like, that whole, like, this is the whole problem with gambling. I immediately regretted not placing more. We bet €40. The net proceeds was about €41 in profit, in wins. And I deleted the app, and I wouldn't allow my son to install it on his phone to examine the odds on anything else. So it's funny, though, but I was like, wow, I wish I'd have placed more bets. I wish I'd have bet more. So I had to cash in and delete the app. But it was a great show. And yeah, Cillian Murphy, he took Best Actor. And I know exactly what dog food his dog eats because I recommended it to him. And I'm not even going to tell our listeners what brand that dog food is, because that's just between me and a Best Actor Oscar winning neighbor.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool to see a couple of fuckle spoken on the Oscar stage as well. He was good.
I have to say, the minute he started speaking Irish, a language I completely rebuked all through school, I felt a swell of pride. I was like, yes, speak more Irish. I just loved it. There's something kind of at a genetic level where I just my fires of pride are stoked when I see something like that. But yeah, it was brilliant. I was delighted to see him win.
Kind of weird how they were talking about the first Irish-born actor to win, and then it's kind of, I think Daniel Day-Lewis is an Irish citizen, and they're kind of, he's born in England. I don't know, it seemed needless. Do you know what I mean?
You're right, it's a little pedantic.
I think we were pretty quick to claim Daniel Day-Lewis. Do you know what I mean? We can't have it both ways.
Right, I see. Yeah, but we also have Pierce Brosnan, but I don't presume he's won any Oscars. Like, for the 007 roles, there weren't
Goldeneye got in, but we have We have a very interesting show. It's marrying a few of my favorite topics, stock talk and conspiracy theories, although this one is a bit tragic, really. So we're going to get into a company that we probably don't talk about enough, considering its importance, I suppose, and that's Boeing. So, Emmett, this is a wild story. Is it a major whistleblower? And he was a former employee of Boeing for 20 years or whatever else. He was found dead in his car in the middle of testifying or doing his deposition against the company in what's been called a suicide. His lawyer came out and said, he kind of said the word apparently in air quotes or whatever. It all looks awful fishy. What's the full details there?
Yeah, it's an unbelievable story. And frankly, I hadn't heard the story until you sent me a message yesterday saying, hey, let's talk about the Boeing story. And when I started to investigate it and read up on it, I just couldn't believe it, because really, of all the businesses that have been embroiled in layers of trouble over the years, this is definitely makes a short list. But anyway, the person in question that you're referring to, his name is John Barnett. He was 62 and a quality manager in Boeing, who retired, as you say, in 2017 after multiple decades with the company. And he died there on 9th of March, so just 4 days ago by our recording time, in South Carolina, from what appeared to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And this, of course, is a tragic end to any life. And we could talk about that for a whole series of podcasts. But this particular tragedy also comes with a serious helping of intrigue. It's unbelievable. Because in 2019, the New York Times ran a story, and it said that Barnett was one of several whistleblowers who raised quality issues with Boeing's South Carolina plant, where the company builds the 787 Dreamliner aircraft. And Barnett had said that he had discovered clusters of metal shavings left near electrical systems for flight controls, which he said could have catastrophic results if the shavings penetrated the wiring. And he said that he repeatedly raised concerns to his supervisors, but he was ignored, and instead he was transferred to another part of the plant. So his narrative was that he made clear that there was a serious problem with this plane, and the hierarchy above him wanted him to just shut up and get out of the way. So he later filed a whistleblower complaint with the FAA. And in 2017, the FAA issued a directive requiring that 787s be cleared of shavings before the delivery, which was according to that story. So really, that was where, I could keep going on this, but really, Mike, I know there's a lot for us to cover here. So let's just stop for a minute, and I want to ask you, what's going on at Boeing?
Yeah, it's mad, because this story is one of so many in recent years that are kind of really making you take a step back and look at this company and be like, what the hell is going on? So you remember back in January, the emergency exit door flew off the plane. Do you remember the videos were going around? Yeah. So that plane was delivered just 2 months before that incident. It's a brand new plane, apparently, and four bolts were missing, it was found. This made Alaska Airlines, were the airliner in charge of that plane, they checked and found that bolts from all their new 737-9 Maxes were loose too. So the FAA, the Federal Aviation Authority, grounded all models. CEO David Calhoun, in like this weird, strange interview on CNBC, he called it a quality escape. Didn't really elaborate on the words quality escape, so whatever the hell that means, took full responsibility and said it won't happen again, yada, 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 whatever. And then just last week, a Latin American flight from Sydney to Auckland, it did a really sudden dip. It caused 50 injuries. It doesn't really give much more info than that. It called it a technical issue, but it's reported that 12 people were brought to the hospital. Apparently one is in a very serious condition. This is on a 787 Dreamliner. I don't know, is that another quality escape? It just seems like the storylines are just racking up. There's no fatalities in that one. Obviously, the tragic story about John Burnett, we can't, we might have a cease and desist letter on this podcast if we kind of delve deeper into that one, so we can't send in there. But it really, really is piling up. And then you go back to the tragic incidents of 2018 and 2019 in Indonesia and Ethiopia, where two flights went down as well. And it really, really brings into question, what the hell is going on at Boeing? I don't have an answer, but I just have more evidence, essentially.
Do they, is it Boeing that makes the Max? I can't remember. Remember there was an airplane, the something Max.
So that was one of the main problem airplanes. And like to look into why these incidents are all happening now, I'm going to do a bit of a history lesson, because clearly there is just a company culture that has been directed away from safety, away from quality, and completely towards maximizing profitability, cutting corners, cutting costs. And like, when we think of these lean, because we laud certain lean operations like this. So if a manager can come in and cut costs and run it much more efficient, but they're not running businesses that are taking passenger aircrafts and 200 people up in the air. Do you know what I mean? So it all goes back. I'm going to do a bit of a U on it now. And when I ask you a very simple question, then I go, well, it goes back to 1997.
But that's the kernel of all problems begins way before they present. So I think you're right to do that. I mean, like, put it this way, my neighbor and one of my best pals, he sent a picture very recently. He was in the West Coast of America with the kind of safety card in an airplane to all the lads on WhatsApp to show us he was on a 737 Max or whatever the plane is called. So even the awareness of, you know, the brand had spread to a friend of mine who, believe me, is no anorak. He wouldn't know a whole lot about airplanes, but why did my friend Phil send me that picture? Go back 30 years.
And it was on Kayak. Do you know the kind of price comparison website for flights and hotels and all the rest? They have an option where you can exclude planes now, and it's out of demand. It's at the top of the page now. So you can exclude the 737 Max and the 787 Dreamliner. Has become a really popular feature. Yeah.
But I know it's irrelevant, but to the storyboard. But I do wonder how many people, what percentage of people are so aware of the brand that they actually click that box. It's something that wouldn't be in my awareness when I'm picking a flight. You know, an average Irish person goes to one of two websites, Ryanair, Aer Lingus, and books their flight. And I don't know about you, but I never inspect what airplane is it, and if they change the plane at the last minute, what are your rights as a consumer? It's a different conversation, I'm sure.
No, and I wouldn't have a clue either, but it goes back to Boeing. Boeing always had this history of like very high repute and all the rest, and then in 1997 it merged with this company called McDonnell Douglas. Now McDonnell Douglas were kind of the opposite. They're very famous for penny pinching and all the rest, and it's passenger aircraft, the DC-10, was actually responsible for 1,100 deaths in the 80s and 90s.
You are kidding me.
Yeah. And so Boeing thought this was a good company to merge with. And what happened was almost immediately, the McDonnell Douglas lads got their hands on the leadership positions, and they brought in the same attitude of cost cutting, shareholder kind of maximization. I think the year after the acquisition was the first buyback. Do you know what I mean? So that kind of set the scene, I suppose. And then this is where we have the incidents with both the 787 Dreamliner and the 737 Max. So they basically found that the most cost-efficient way to build the plane turned into more of an assembly job, where they relied on a number of subcontractors instead of building everything in-house. Obviously, this isn't going to be as coherent as or efficient as just producing everything yourself. 787 Dreamliner was the first kind of major casualty of this. Separate pieces didn't fit together properly. Do you know what I mean? If you have a subcontractor, and they themselves have a subcontractor, you know, there's no cohesion between them building the nose and this fella building the seats or whatever else. So that's kind of what happened. And there were actually, what happened with the 787 Dreamliner was that there were a number of in-air fires, apparently due to a faulty battery from a subcontractor that Boeing didn't audit properly or whatever. So the FAA grounded the Dreamliner, and it was the first time it had grounded a commercial airplane since the McDonnell Douglas's DC-10 back in the 80s. So yeah, and it's just a hot mess. And there's actually a famous video from Al Jazeera. It went around, it was kind of like a hidden camera basically, and it went around to the workers at a Dreamliner factory asking them would they fly on this plane, and 10 out of 15 said they wouldn't.
What? Oh my goodness. It's an incredible story. Oh my goodness. I mean, that's crazy. I remember years and years ago when I was in school, my friend of mine's father worked in a a food factory called Walsh's, and they used to make spice burgers, which at the time were available in all the chippers in Ireland. And I remember it was my friend's life mission to tell us all to never order a Walsh's. So like we all heeded his warning. But but when you hear someone building a plane saying I wouldn't get on that yoke, although there, you know, that immediately draws parallels in my mind to a conference that we spoke about here in the podcast probably about a year ago, which was all about AI and a number of people working in the industry who feared that AI is basically going to become our overlords and they didn't want anything to do with it. Now, they have the inside track, but sometimes too much knowledge can disempower you from bigger picture thinking. But in this instance, I would say that is not a good look. And even though the cause of Boeing's issues is as you described with McDonnell, what are they called? McDonnell Douglas, of course. You could also say there's another cause, which is the world's focus on a single number for giant businesses, which is profit. Like, so if you can add a shave of a percentage to a profit line, your job, quote unquote, has been fulfilled and your purpose has been achieved.
No, completely. And that's what led to the tragic crashes in Ethiopia and Indonesia as well. So essentially, Airbus brought out this A320neo and it was really fuel efficient, and Boeing were on their heels with that. So they basically rushed production of this 737 MAX, which didn't really change much. It stuck bigger engines onto the regular 737. And then what that caused was the nose to lift higher in certain situations because it had to move the engines forward or something. And so they installed this. This was the cause of the two crashes, this MCAS software system, which essentially would automatically lower the nose if it felt it was rising. But what happened was Boeing didn't even, because they wanted to get it out so fast and reduce costs, they said it was so similar to the 737 that pilots wouldn't have to train on the simulator first. And they didn't even tell people about this MCAS system. So when the nose was diving down out of nowhere, the pilots weren't even aware that there was a system in place that was doing that. So it's absolutely shocking. And I'm like, you think about this, like it's cost cutting and there's about 400 lives lost because of that. And I don't know, we're going to get into Boeing as a company and how important it is to the US economy and all the rest, but that's mad. Like, do you know what I mean? And the responsibility and where the chit lies for it just doesn't really seem to be that evident. Like,
that's right. I mean, since the dawn of the mechanical age, there's been case studies in businesses that have weighed up a fiscal cost versus a human well-being cost and a human life cost. And I'm really trying to work off an ancient distant memory here, but as far as I recall, Ford had a very significant case in the 1950s, where they had a choice to recall their entire fleet, if you like, of cars on the roads, because if you hit the back of them, it would ignite. And they did a kind of cost-benefit analysis of the price of paying out to fix all of the cars versus the price of paying out to fix all of the damage done to human beings. And the accountants won through by saying, just leave the cars out there and we deal with issues as they happen. Now, I'm going to put Ford in triangular brackets for our listeners to say it might not have been Ford. I'm not certain. This has to be cited.
These major accusations mightn't be on this.
No, I'd bet, hey, let me give me a Paddy Power app. I bet it was Ford in the 50s, but this was a real MBA case study in a business that really was using the wrong measurement. It's, you know, measurement tool. And this is exactly what we're talking about here, but it's such a blurred boundary. How do you, like, so when an incident happens, like, for example, that flight from Auckland to Sydney there just during the week where it just fell out of the sky, if it was attributable to a mechanical or electrical or microelectronic failure within the plane or malfunction, what does the company do with that information? How do they roll out a fix to their entire fleet if it's a black swan event? If it's the first time they've ever seen it, if it was like, oh, well, in this particular plane, the red wire was a bit loose. you know, do they, is it on them to go and make sure the red wire is plugged in tight on every plane? I would say yes. But when you look actually at this blurred boundary of an event versus what's up, the stakes against it, you really have to step back and go, it's a complex equation.
Absolutely. And that kind of brings into question what happens with Boeing from here. And I don't know the answer, because the reality of the matter is it's in this major duopoly. There's only two aircraft manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus.
There's a Brazilian outfit, Embraer or something like that. They think they're a close third. Yeah. But anyway, go on and get your point. It is a duopoly.
Yeah, it employs about 200,000 people. It's one of the USA's top exporters. It's 100 and something billion dollar company. It's incredibly important supplier to the US government. And in fact, it's probably as close to a government supported entity as there is without officially being one. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely an argument it's one of the most important businesses in the US. So it's obviously like not going away anytime soon. Do you know what I mean? Like, there just really, really needs to be some serious cultural changes that bed down, and I don't know, there needs to be a kind of trade-off. And I think investors, which probably won't happen, but need to accept, okay, the stock price and profits aren't priority anymore.
Sorry, Mike, but when you think of the long tail of repercussions from an incident, so if taking the Auckland, New Zealand flight, it was determined that it was a failing of the aircraft, how many people in America today, how many of the millions and millions of people who are getting on and off a plane in America today will take one action that kind of alters their course because of what happened in Auckland, Sydney? I would say zero. And when you think about that, because, you know, people's plans get hardwired, it's news, it's out there, it won't happen to me. But it's a very complex thing. I mean, think of, as you rightfully say, the Boeing brand is, as it is to aviation, what I suppose Coca-Cola is to soft drinks, or IBM is to computing. It is like one of the world's mega brands. People trust their brands. They're like, you know, they'll get it fixed. But that's it. Will they get it fixed? Or is it kind of like, okay, let's hope that doesn't happen again?
Yeah, well, it's definitely in the too big to fail category. Do you know what I mean? It's going to have every opportunity to fix it. I imagine we'd see new leadership and probably from an external position. Do you know what I mean? Bring someone in from the outside. I saw they're already bringing in a new bonus structure. So it's not tied to financial targets anymore. It's tied to safety and quality metrics. But yeah, no, the FAA came in and did an audit. I think it said it failed 33 of 89 audits on the 737 MAX. The administrator for the FAA says it won't be back to business as usual for Boeing. So there's a lot up in the air now. I think it was looking to reacquire one of its suppliers, Spirit AeroSystems, which would kind of give it more control over the production process. Now, that could be great posturing for the company, and the fact that, like, oh, we'll start buying our subcontractors so we can control the process when it's them that set up this process in the first place. But I don't know. It really, really raises some questions.
Yeah, look, I mean, did you say they failed 33 out of 89 safety tests?
Yeah, that's what came out on the 737 MAX.
So they can't, and did they ground the entire fleet as a consequence of that?
That fleet has been grounded. I'm not sure if it's back up in the air since they made fixes. I think they have until late May to bring a plan, basically. But yeah, it's all over the place.
I mean, if your best friend goes off to study medicine, the pass rate is 70% for most exams in medicine, because you don't want a doctor looking at you who said, oh, look, I wasn't in that day. I was never very good at the ear. You know, because this, people's lives are at stake. So the pass rate is high. And to think that that a business can still just go about its way when it has a 33 out of 89 safety failure rate is just beggar's belief, really.
Yeah. Before we leave this topic, when I brought it up, you mentioned you had a good story about this kind of intrigue and corporate espionage and all the rest. And it's actually a supplier of Boeing as well in Rolls-Royce. So what's the story there?
Yeah, it was the Rolls-Royce engine business scandal, and it came to light in specific detail in January 2017 and revolved around accusations of widespread bribery and corruption within Rolls-Royce PLC, which is, as you said, it's a British multinational aerospace and defence company. And this is, by the way, not to be confused with Rolls-Royce automotive brand, which is often a confusing point. So when you think of Rolls-Royce cars, different company that's owned by BMW. The one we're talking about is an engineering company, which is among the world's leading manufacturers of aircraft engines. And as much as Boeing and Airbus have a duopoly, I'd say Rolls-Royce could very much have. I can't think who's their second. They're nearly monopolistic. I know Rolls-Royce engines and planes go hand in hand. But anyway, the allegations at the time indicated that Rolls-Royce had engaged in corrupt practices over absolutely decades to win contracts in countries pretty much all around the world, including Indonesia, Thailand, India, Russia, Nigeria, China, Malaysia. The roll call of countries and the number of years in which they were kind of offering bribes was just monumental. And these practices, as they were kind of called out, included paying bribes to intermediaries, paying bribes to government officials, paying bribes to businesses, just in order to secure lucrative contracts for civil and defense aviation, for energy projects and all that kind of stuff. And at the time, the UK's Serious Fraud Office, or the SFO, along with a similar authority in the US and Brazil, actually conducted a really long, lengthy investigation into the business. And Rolls-Royce cooperated, very decent of them to do that, which revealed misconduct involving millions and millions of pounds and bribes and kickbacks and all the rest. And as a result, Rolls-Royce agreed to a deferred prosecution agreement, or DPA, and with the authorities, they agreed to pay penalties totaling 671 million quid, which at the time is like $800 million, just to settle the allegations, of course, without admitting criminal liability. And the company also implemented changes, and it kind of did a Boeing, we're all about safety, we're all about good standards, we're all about good governance, and we have a big checklist of compliance procedures, and it won't happen again. Of course they did. But the net upshot is that the scandal highlighted really significant issues in a lot of international business practices. At the time, there was a lot of discussions in the media about ethics and compliance and governance, and especially in the aerospace and defense industry. And I guess it's a story or a cautionary tale on the importance of ethics in business. And it's amazing, because when I look at Rolls-Royce holdings today, I have my dashboard open here. It's a $33 billion business in pounds, but at its in pounds, a 33 billion pound business, but at the peak of disillusionment around September 2020, shares are about 44 pence a pop. Now they're about £3.87. So from the pit of disillusionment, that stock has grown about eightfold in a very short period of time, which means they, of course, everyone loves a recovery story and everyone loves a turnaround play in their stock portfolio.
There you go. Right. I just realized as well, we should have probably given a warning that if you're afraid of flying, to skip this part, but it's a bit late now.
Oh well. Hey Mike, we might have saved a life. We might get a letter in a few weeks. You know that one that went down there in such and such? I didn't take that because of your podcast.
I don't even want to talk about it. All right. So quick reminder, folks, from our friends at Vodafone Business, they're the sponsor of the Stock Club. Check out their free one-to-one digital support and advice service today to discuss a range of topics from social media tips, cybersecurity, and building a website for your business. Search Vodafone VHub or click on the link in the show notes.
Just go and talk to them, folks. I meant to say that. Sorry, Mike. I was looking out the window. Just go in and talk. Go into Vodafone and go, hey, here, Emmett sent me. Mike sent me. What's the story? You're going to fix my business up.
All right. We're getting into big deal or no deal now. So.
Right. Okay. I'm going to hit you with a slightly older deal or no big deal. And it's about Apple's long rumored driverless car project, also known as Project Titan, which I'm sure most of our listeners have heard has been shuttered, but the company didn't announce its cancellation. In fact, Apple barely ever mentioned the secretive project despite laboring on it for, I think it was 10 years. So is this a deal or a no big deal?
Yeah, because of that, it's tough to say whether it is or not. Like, you know, I couldn't imagine Apple bringing out a car and it not being a big deal. Do you know what I mean? And I guess they're thinking, because this has been going on for 10 years, so they're thinking at the time was cars are kind of the next evolution of computers in a sense. Modern cars are essentially a computer on wheels. Throw in autonomous driving and you kind of can 10x that statement. And Google are very firmly in that space as well. You know, Apple just thought, well, we can take our design expertise and put it on top of this. But given how tight-lipped everything has been, it's tough to really say how far along the project was or if it would have ever really come to fruition to be a mass market thing. I think something like car production is so far out of Apple's wheelhouse that like the margin profiles and all the rest and the competitiveness of it, don't know if it would really suit the business. I'd say there are some investors quite happy about that, that they're not kind of going down this rabbit hole and adding more distractions, especially considering, you know, it's kind of seeing some roadblocks at the minute and China and all the rest. So I'd kind of just look at this as the same vein as one of Google's moonshots. Do you know what I mean? If it comes off, great. If not, you know, we have more cash than we know what to do with. There's nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I ain't going to say no big deal, but just because I don't have enough information on it, I don't think anyone does. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'd agree with you. I'd say they canceled it for good reason. I mean, the business intelligence inside Apple, I think I had something like 2,000 people working on it, and they were redeployed into AI or dispatched into the workplace. But when you think of a skunk works of 2,000 people, if I'm right in that number, it's mad. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so this one mightn't affect me or you, the old fogies we are, but the Republican-controlled House will soon vote on a bill requiring TikTok to either be divested from ByteDance or face a nationwide ban. So ByteDance is its Beijing-based owner. So the House Committee on Energy and Commerce unanimously passed the measure last Thursday, and the House Majority Leader, Steve Scalise, said he will bring it to vote as early as Wednesday, which is today. So we might actually hear more about it once this pod comes out. Emmett, big deal or no big deal?
Yeah, well, the bill's primary backer is a Republican called Mike Gallagher, and he says the app poses, quote, a grave threat to U.S. national security due to its Chinese ownership, and basically warns that TikTok could be used to influence the U.S. public opinion or worse, harness user data to spy on Americans. And as I think everyone knows, ByteDance is controlled by Chinese authorities, and America describes the app as Communist Party malware, which is quite, the conspiracy theory. But the bill's sponsors have really pushed back on the idea that they want to ban TikTok, saying that the objective is to get rid of foreign control. So there's a nuance to it. And this guy Gallagher said that America's foremost adversary has no business controlling a dominant media platform in the United States, which, you know, I think is fair enough. It's not otherworldly, but divestment could mean selling the app to a US-based company, although the specific definition of a qualified divestiture would have to be determined by no less than the US president. So the bill also creates a process for the president to designate certain social media apps as, quote, subject to the control of a foreign adversary, meaning other apps could be signaled out as well. So it's really going to the very, very top. And the two top 24 presidential contenders have also complicated the dynamics, because Biden has thrown his support behind the White House Republicans' measure, and Trump there just on Monday seemingly undercut his fellow Republicans by reversing his position and coming out against a potential TikTok ban. And in an interview on CNBC I was watching, he said that he still thinks the app is a national security risk, but warned that the ban could lead to increased support for Facebook, which he lambasted as an enemy of the people. So to your question, is it a deal or no big deal? I'm very flippant about it. I'm kind of like, who cares? So I think it's no big deal. Like, so what? Leave them to it. Like, a politician will always love a great debate. I mean, it's like that thing I think I said once in a podcast is, you know, when you're fighting, scrapping with a pig in a farmyard and rolling around in muck, having a big fight with a pig, there comes a point where you realize the pig is enjoying it. Well, that's that's actually what, when you when you basically go into a debate with a politician, sure, they're delighted. Just TikTok, enemy of the state. Hold on a minute. So you're going to have fiery words and but who cares? I mean, seriously, will TikTok still be available in America? I don't know. But even if it isn't, the next thing will be there.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you just on the political sentiment behind it. It's tough to take it seriously, especially because this happened. Was it around the same time, about 4 years ago, when Trump was threatening to ban it? And it seems to kind of be a political rally cry. Yeah, if you zoom out, like, none of America's social media companies are allowed in China. So it will kind of just be returning the favor a bit. You know, they don't want US controlled apps and data to be within China. And the US hasn't done the same thing at all the other way around. So yeah, I'm not really sure how I feel about it that much, to be honest. I think it could be a bit of bravado and showing, or maybe it's deadly serious and it's like, oh, well, you know, this is just us returning the favor and we don't want Chinese influence. If you want to get into the conspiracy of it, apparently TikTok in China for like kids and stuff is all very educational and all this, and it's like very productive. And then TikTok,
that's right, get some better mathematics. Yeah,
exactly. America is just whatever. Like it can be whatever you want, and you can get educational stuff out of it. But you know, it can also be just people doing silly dances and stuff.
So in a straw poll of one, do you use TikTok, Mike?
No.
Not at all? So you don't kind of go, I'll give 5 minutes and then spend an hour flicking through videos?
I never got into it, and then now I've avoided it because I know I'd probably get addicted to it. So it's kind of like a pre-prevention process.
I gave it a shot. And what I mean by that is I created a few videos for TikTok on the stock market. And well, firstly, I'm no video producer, that's for sure. So I didn't find it easy, didn't come naturally. Like a 30-second video could take like a half an hour for me to actually compose and think about and do. So I was like, nah, I don't see a return on investment on this. Anyway, look, speaking of return on investment, there's one thing I wanted to mention, Mike, before we push on to your pitch. You're doing a pitch, aren't you?
I'm doing a pitch, yeah.
Yeah, I could pull one out of the hat, but I'm glad it's you. so our listeners know, just we always say, get on our mailing list to get our latest offers, get news, get updates on our podcast. Just go to mywallstreet.com and stick your email in there. But as our listeners know, we recently launched a product called Invest, which is $99. And what it is we've picked 10 stocks to buy and hold for 10 years. You and I, Mike, deliberated over this with a lot of our advisors. And we've basically think it's a great foundational list of businesses that all of them we believe are going to grow in value. And for your 99 bucks, you also get access to Charging a Fierce Library, which grows by one stock pick a week. And Invest Plus is a $200 service, which also has Stock in a Month, which has beaten the market soundly for years and years and years, almost since it launched. Not almost, actually since it launched in 2017. And the reason I mention it is that we've just added a new section to Invest on three wildcard pitches. And a wildcard is, as its name suggests, a stock investment that comes with more uncertainty and more risk compared to others and has been sold off and is misunderstood and stock price has plummeted 90, maybe 95%. And we've found three wild cards. You and I deliberated and debated these stocks. I think they're wonderful businesses. And just I'll tell you what they are. I'll give you three teasers. One is a company on the brink of a remarkable resurgence thanks to a big, huge, massive funding deal. The next is a company that I've invested in over and over and over and happen to believe it's going to be one of the greatest investments of our generation, but it has been destroyed in the last couple of years. So I think it's on for a triumphant return, and it's set for profitability in 2025. And then the third wild card is a company which has actually, Anne-Marie lambasted the company about a year and a half ago, and I fully agreed with her, but it actually has proven us all wrong and has reignited investor enthusiasm. And those three wildcard stocks are available. Just sign up to Invest. And it's, or is it Invest Plus or Invest? Just Invest, isn't it, Mike? So our entry level service, $99, you'll get those three stocks. You'll get our 10 foundational stocks and you get a stock idea every single week written by you, Mike, or me, or one of our team. And it's a fabulous service. Look, just go into Vodafone and ask them, can you borrow the Wi-Fi and sign up for Invest? Right, go on here. Where am I? Oh, yeah. Listen, talk to me. Tell me about a stock that people don't have to go through the strain of signing up for. Tell me, what's the story?
Give
me.
You get this one for free. I think now after I did it up, I can't remember, but Anne-Marie might have pitched this stock a million years ago as well. But sure, no harm for the new listeners to get a top up either way. So the company is called Garmin. Yeah, it's hard to quantify what they do in one go because I could guess you could call them navigation specialists. Does that make sense? So focusing on GPS technology.
They do yours and John Tyrrell's golf watch. Is that right?
Yeah. So that's one of five pretty distinct revenue streams. So they have fitness wearables, so the watches. They have marine navigation, outdoor navigation, aviation navigation, and then auto navigation. So if depending on your age profile, you might have first associated them with the portable sat navs you'd find in the rental cars. Do you remember them, yokes? Yeah. So obviously now they've become a bit defunct, but that wasn't their first product at all. So they initially, I think their first ever product was bought by the military, these portable GPS devices. And at the same time, it was producing marine GPS devices as well. Obviously, then since then, it's become a kind of multi-product business. It's most consumer facing is the one we talked about, the wearable technology, which is incredibly fast growing. And I know that's a competitive industry. You see the Apple Watch and all the rest of the Fitbits are there too, but it's still bringing in incredible revenue and its margins. It's interesting as well. I think because it's so competitive, its margins aren't as great in wearables as it is in, say, marine or aviation lines. But just to see that business have such a diversified kind of income stream that, say, like the auto line now is kind of falling off and its margins are gone down and I think it's barely eking out a profit, but it's less and less important because it's bringing in so much from everywhere else. So it's a really nice business. It really does seem to have a bit of a moat when it comes to GPS technology. I don't know how sustainable that would be if everyone else catches up, which I think they are, but I don't think it would be making money in these kind of specialist industries and wouldn't be selling to military if it hadn't. So that's kind of what I'm leaning on there. So yeah, coming off the chaos that was Boeing, it's also nice to see that it has a great company culture. It was just voted number two on Forbes best large employers list, and yeah, just the numbers are really steady sales growth, great returns on capital, consistent around the 20% mark. So if you put a euro into the top of the business, 120 comes out eventually. Growing dividend yield at about 2%, nothing to be sniffed at all. Lots of cash, virtually no debt, plenty, about $1 billion in cash flow coming in every year, really solid margins. So yeah, nothing fancy, but one definitely worth doing some extra reading on and keeping an eye on.
So can I ask you two questions? And it's a little unfair because you mightn't know the answer, but do you mind if I hit you up with these two questions?
Do they
have their own satellites?
Yeah.
They do. Okay, fair play. First question, green light. So that you would think that's a pretty decent differentiator, a barrier to entry, I should say. It's not, you won't have a bunch of like nerds in a basement building the next software platform. Well, you do have that, but ones that are actually going to get some satellites up into the sky is slightly beyond the average reach of a startup.
Yeah, but I think access to satellites now is very different than what was in the 90s. Do you know what I mean?
That is true, but I wonder, is there a competitive advantage in having your own network up there? But not for now. The second question is, how accurate are these things? I mean, John is telling me, our colleague John Tyrrell is telling me he wears this Garmin watch for putting a ball. I'm like, honestly, are you telling me that a satellite can tell you the number of meters you are or yards from a pin?
Yeah, well, completely. Like, sure, it can tell you how many steps you do. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So is it combining like a MEMS, a micro electronic sensor inside the yoke, counting your steps with the satellite? Or is it just pure satellite, just goes up and it knows how many steps you've taken?
Yeah, whatever. The connection to your watch, to the eye in the sky and back again. I can't tell you exactly.
Yeah, but that's amazing though, isn't it? That like the number of steps and that, I mean, that level of precision is something that I wasn't very sensitive to when I use Google Maps or whatever. I see the blue dot, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's pretty much where I am. But when it, you know, when you're putting a ball on the golf course, that's quite incredible, really. But look, sure, for all that I know, everyone has it. I don't know.
I think it's becoming less and less spectacular, but still, yeah, no, it is. It's impressive.
It is impressive. Look, its return on equity is 20%. That's great. We'll take it.
We will. We'll always take those numbers. Okay. Before we finish up, just a thank you to our friends at Vodafone Business. If you're a business owner in need of a leg up when it comes to your digital transformation, get yourself over to Vodafone VHub to book your appointment today. You can find the link in our show notes. Or Emmett, where can you go?
Just go talk to him, walk into a shop and go, Emmett and Mike sent me. What's the story?
There you go. All right. That's it for today's show. Emmett, thank you for joining me and thank you everyone for listening in. Remember to see those three wildcards, the 10 foundational stocks and your weekly stock pitch into your inbox every week. You can just sign up for Invest Now at mywallstreet.com. And as always, make sure you're on our mailing list to get latest offers, news, podcast updates and more. If you're not in it, you can't win it. Thanks for joining us today and we will talk to you next week.